Hello, and welcome back to Hero with a Thousand Potions, a gaming podcast where two game-likers in their 30s discuss the storytelling and gameplay of popular niche RPGs in a book club-like format. I'm Tyler.
I'm Nate.
It's season two. We're at the tail end of our coverage of Final Fantasy VII Remake and its parallel content in the original game released back in 1997. Today we are beginning chapter 18, the last chapter of Remake, and I can't wait to get through this, Nate. How are you doing, pal?
I'm doing all right. I'm going to say here, right at the front, there's some stuff we're going to address in this episode that I'm going to guess there are potential answers to in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. And I want to say right off the bat that I am not that far in the game and you are behind me. So you are definitely not far in the game. So when we've talked about our Rebirth journey, that it is simply just happening. In a previous episode, know that we're incredibly slow and we still have no clue on the answers to what is necessarily happening in this chapter, and anything we say will be just speculation.
You might say we have more questions than we have answers.
Right.
Nate, how many hours are you in Rebirth?
Not far enough to have answers, but my save file is 75 hours right now.
I'm at 40.
Right. You know, that's just an example of how that game is just packed full of stuff to do to where you don't have to do all that stuff. But if you do, your runtime is going to balloon pretty quickly without actually you can be at 50 hours and not be half done with the game yet.
Oh, I'm expecting it to be a 150 hour experience.
Somewhere around there. Yeah, I've heard 120 is what I heard from a YouTuber.
My projection was that, but yeah, probably. Yeah, maybe 150 is a little high, but
yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, we're still living the mystery.
It's good. It's good. Yeah. Happy Easter. It's Easter.
Oh, right.
Today, Easter evening. Did you celebrate, Nate?
My wife is on the boat right now, so not really. I did an egg hunt with my kid. We went over to the neighbor's house and did all that. As far as our like family Easter, we actually did that Saturday night instead.
Nice. I went over to my sister-in-law's where we had a ham luncheon and Easter egg hunt for the kids. I helped build a trampoline, a giant 16 feet diameter trampoline. That was a big surprise for the kids, and like their Easter egg hunt was followed by an Easter egg scavenger hunt that led them over the course of a series of clues inside of openable eggs to the backyard where they didn't realize there was a giant trampoline. And the trampoline with the big like netting all around it feels like an Easter basket itself where there were other baskets. So it's just like big Easter basket at the end of the adventure for them. They loved it.
Right.
Now my kid loves trampolines. She's like, you know, not even 20 pounds and she's getting thrown around with all the other kids jumping around. It's very, very funny to see her like extremely unsteady and like loving it.
Nice.
Yeah, it was fun. But enough of that shit. Let's go to Midgar.
So yeah, we just had a cloud drive out a window onto a freeway.
Gnarly.
Along with a small truck carrying four people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, three people and a dog thing.
This is the start of chapter 18. It's titled Destiny's Crossroads. So if we're reading into anything, if we're paying attention to what's going on in terms of the Whisper reveal back in Hojo's lab, we're at odds with Destiny, or Destiny's going to maybe take another path. Destiny's Crossroads. So we've got the two vehicles. They're driving down this Midgar Expressway. Baird and Red 13 see countless Whispers swarming the Shinra building. And the gang pulls over to watch the Whispers encase the building in a dense vortex-like fog of their own ghostly bodies. Now, if they're trying to flee the Midgar building, maybe you wouldn't want to just pull over. I would probably still want to keep getting out of Dodge, but they do. And then the scene shifts to being inside the executive office of the Midgar building, where Rufus notices these specters, and he wonders, what are these things as they pass through the floors and walls and ceilings of the office? And Sung is there too, and he asks what's wrong. Rufus flashes a look at him, who suddenly has a phone call he needs to make, and excuses himself. Now, Nate, Sung's response to Rufus was, what's wrong? Are we to infer that Rufus sees the Whispers, but Sung does not?
That's definitely what I took away from it, yeah.
Yeah, weird. It's unusual. I don't know what that means. Was Rufus touched by Sephiroth at some point so he could see the Whispers, or had he handled Aerith in some way in the past and so he's able to see them as well? Because that's kind of how Cloud became cognizant of them in the beginning of chapter 2.
Yeah.
I don't know. They don't really explain it.
It's weird because he just got there. The only connection would be getting his ass beat by Cloud. That Cloud infected him.
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Because Sung hasn't touched Cloud. Also, Heidegger, in the previous scene, Cloud hit everyone else with his motorcycle tire, except it came within an inch of Heidegger's face. So That's another person that has not been physically contacted by Cloud or his items in any way. Yeah, that's kind of where I would lean, is the fight with Cloud. At one point in their tussle, there was some contact of more than just blades. I don't know.
Darkstar bit Cloud, and then Darkstar licked Rufus after the fight.
Right. Rufus, not knowing any of this, he's probably thinking, probably bad to have done so many mushrooms on the day my dad dies.
Yeah, probably. That's strange. That's fucking strange. Right, so then we cut right back to the expressway, and Baird wonders out loud if Wedge got caught up in all of this. As far as they know, he's still in the Shinra building, but we know Wedge is no longer in the Shinra building, for he has been defenestrated by the Whispers. We presume he's dead. Sorry, Barrett.
The Whispers have had it out for Wedge. We know that, but I don't know, with all the shifts and changes and crossroads of fate, maybe they just like carried him off on a Whisper plane somewhere.
God knows if Wedge comes back, but my money's on probably not. Red 13 says, Shinra forces are on their way, so we pile back into our vehicles and continue our escape. A moment later, a squad of Shinra forces on motorcycles give chase. Then we get into the gameplay of Chapter 18, which begins with us on the motorcycle playing out the crazy motorcycle experience that we remember so fondly, or maybe not, from original. This is coming back to Chapter 4, our race on our motorcycles with Jesse and Biggs and Wedge around the other motorcycle. Here it is again. We didn't have that experience in Chapter 4 in original. I forget if we answered that question back in Chapter 4, but here it is again. And you might ask yourself, why did we have to have this twice? And I wonder if it's because, well, the gameplay is so rich and unique to the rest of the gameplay in Remake that they wanted to have it twice. Or maybe prime you with the experience a couple hours into the game and then come back to it later for a bigger, better, more thrilling experience.
I think we talked about patterning a little bit, and if you're going to design a game, give it some replayability, because if we talk about OG Final Fantasy, it is a game they developed that has that multiple entry points here. But since we have, because later you get to go to Gold Saucer and replay the game to your heart's content. So the payoff, the amount of development time they put into it existing, and then the value, I don't know, like the time played value comes out in the ability to replay it again. And we don't get that in this. So, and there isn't really a way to deliver it unless like Chadley was going to be like, I did VR bike for you, which he doesn't. So this game does have chapter replay, which when you're finished, would make it super easy to replay it if you wanted to. But I think it's just kind of that like adding value where it would be blasphemy to skip making the bike game. So they're going to get the value out of it that they can by putting it in other places. And I think also the earlier version of this game gave us an excuse to get Roche on the game board, on the playing field as a character. So we got that. I don't know why he exists or why, like, somebody in the design room, in the character writing room, felt like he needed to exist. So that was a perfect way to do that, because I think it'd be a little narratively like off kilter to have Roche here now, like almost like a distraction in a way.
Yeah, they felt like the Chapter 4 experience needs to lead up to something. We want to give it to you twice, but we've got to have it all come to a head in some sort of way, which necessitated a villain like Roche.
Yeah, and I think the Chapter 4 itself, in as far as an idea of like, we're going to go topside, we're going to meet Jesse's family, et cetera, like that's cool. But as far as things you actually do in the chapter, it's pretty bare.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something like Crisis Core has a lot of those, like, oh, we're going to have you walk around Midgar. We need to come up with a random ass excuse why you're just going to be beating shit up in the streets. Whereas this, it does away with that. It's like, no, you wouldn't be just fighting in the middle of the streets at like midnight or like seven. I don't know what time it is when we get there, until you would be infiltrating the base.
In Remake, we've got much more than just motorcycles. In original, you just have motorcycles that you fight. We've got armored trucks that show up that we've got to attack. There are attack helicopters dropping missiles all around us, drones that shoot lasers or create an electrical explosion around itself, moth units, which are those droids with the sphere below the torso with the spinning rotating blades, like bisecting the sphere. And when you fight them, they shoot salvos of spinning blades at you. It's riveting. It's fun. Meanwhile, in original, this is the future informing the past. When I say, like, you're just fighting motorcycle units, it's fine, but I think it was a really great minigame at the time, and I did play a lot of it in Gold Saucer, in original, trying to get a high score. But I have to admit that the hitbox of Cloud's sword swings, but they're not even swings, they're like weird flat side of the blade ahead taps, they are awkward and hard to time because there's a lot of wind up for hitting to the left or the right.
What you said there, hitbox, is a pretty good word to use, because like in modern gaming, they have the ability to program like geometry collides with geometry equals a hit, right? They don't necessarily need to program these like super specific hitboxes, but you can kind of tell the way OG works. Like there's probably just an invisible square on the ground, and the Cloud is just like painting a square over that, and that's what constitutes a hit. Because there will be times where like you'll fully swipe and you will watch the sword pass through enemies and it did no damage because like they were a pixel outside of that box that you stated was there. And so yeah, it's pretty wishy-washy. Obviously, like we didn't care back then in the 90s, like this, to have anything even in this space. Holy shit. I don't know, maybe that was your reaction, but for me, it was like you created a save point. Once you knew that this was here, your second time through, you made an extra save point on your memory card that could only save 15 things. You allocated a spot for this.
You did that? I wish I did that. That sounds like a smart idea back then.
Probably because of the cutscene too, because Gold Saucer, they don't give you that cutscene.
Oh, sure. You wanted to see the cutscene again. That's interesting.
I also had one like in the Nibelheim flashback because I wanted to show it to friends. I wanted, when my friends came over, like I was a Final Fantasy VII prophet. And I think I've said that in past episodes here too. Like I would just be like, all right, dude, you're coming over and I'm showing you this. Your coworker, my sister, who's been married like, I don't know, what is it, 25 years now? When she first met her husband, and like, oh, there's this new guy, this boyfriend. The very first thing I did when he came over one day, I was like, dude, I'm going to show you Final Fantasy VII. So anyway, that was 10-year-old me. So yeah, good times.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, Barrett destroys the attack helicopter with a big shot, but it looks like it's about to crash land on top of the truck. Cloud looks back and sees Whispers are shielding them through the carnage, through the explosion. And so the helicopter does not crash land onto our heroes. Barrett wonders if the Whispers are on our side now, but Red 13 clarifies that they are really just here to preserve the flow of destiny. We are rehearsing the points that we learned a few beats ago.
I'll say this about that. In the original, you get this perception that like the Shinra soldiers are just kind of bumping into the truck and trying to like disable the truck. Whereas in remake here, they're just trying to murder all of us with missiles and bombs and everything. And so like that decree, nobody took a minute at the meeting with President Shinra there that happened a few hours earlier before he died, where he said, hey, don't kill the ancient this time, idiots. Don't do that. Nobody recorded that in the meeting because they are all trying to murder the shit out of Aerith in her truck.
Yeah, and Motorball probably doesn't know to have that sort of discretion either.
Fucking Motorball.
Here we go. So Motorball shows up. The name's a little dumb, but holy crap, is this guy cool. So it's a little too like the Arsenal, I'm a little ashamed to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's cool. So Motorball, big tank droid, like a tank or centaur droid. Six huge wheels. They're like 8 or 10 feet tall, and they got spikes on them, three to his side, like monster truck tires with spikes on them. The torso and above is outfitted with all kinds of weapons, flamethrowers, machine guns. There's other things I can't recall. It can throw mines out in the road to you. It'll ram you with spiked wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And the boss fight is on. This is intense. And in my first playthrough of Remake, I'm going to call it one of my favorite boss fights. Not only because we're synergizing all of the things that we learned over the course of the two motorcycle segments. We're learning how to speed up and slow down, because you got to slow down at certain points.
He's going to step on you if you don't slow down.
Yeah. Yeah. He's going to pulverize you. Or also, like, once it, because it has a sequence of moves, and like the final sequence of the moves is a flamethrower's 360 spin around itself. And so you got to like hang back for that one. It's got a huge death laser that just like melts the highway that on one side of the highway that you're on. The music is intense. The fighting is intense. Got to slash up the wheels in order to stagger the guy. I was completely riveted playing it. And I died. I actually died to Motorball in my replay here when I fought him. This is my last game over of the season.
And the interesting thing is that in OG, Motorball is just like a standard fight. It's not part of the bike section at all.
Mm.
But they have a model for him at the end of the bike segment of like chasing you down the highway and having this oh shit moment. So they created like a low res version of him.
Oh, that's right. They do.
Instead of just like, you know, you get to the end and then... I think it's interesting that they made it part of the motorcycle segment. It's a really good choice because, as we've talked about, we're in like boss rush territory here, where in OG, you're kind of like fighting bosses back to back to back to back. And you can kind of get screwed where you're in a position where you're just not kitted out correctly with who you end up fighting with here because of all that swapping back and forth you did. Because you're solo Cloud and now you're running away as Aerith, Barrett, and Red 13. Tifa's not in the party, and there's all these materia swaps you're doing, and you can kind of end up in a shitty situation where, because of all the boss rushing, you're not really equipped to do Motorball that well in like a standard fight. But here it's working seamlessly with the motorcycle segment. Just makes so much more sense. It almost seems like with that old low res model, they had thought of doing that originally, and then they're just like, we don't know how to make this work, so we'll make him a boss instead. It's also cool because, like, we've talked in past episodes how Airbuster in the original, he's just like a hovercraft with arms and his missiles and stuff. In remake, he straight up just goes into full flight mode and flies off the edge of the platform, and you kind of got to use Barrett or magic or whatever. They've evolved these robot designs to have a lot more utility to them. Motorball as this tank, well, he has a much more like, I don't want to say human feel to him, but he has moves, right? So he, like I said, he'll stomp on you. He has this move where he'll like lean on one end, and his tires, wheels are so versatile that they'll like move in waves, and he can hop up and down and like stomp on you with the tires. It's really cool to see them kind of evolve these without just changing it, without making it something completely different. It's like you instantly recognize what it is, but you're shocked and surprised at what they're doing as you encounter them now.
In original, it is a challenging boss fight for the reasons you explained. He's got two phases. One is, well, upright form, and one is flamethrower form. He'll spew AoE flames all over everybody in flamethrower form. He'll run over you. He'll like grind on you guys. But the fight is over pretty fast in my memory. And for as cool as the enemy is, it marks the end of the Midgar segment of the game, because what follows is a little conversation at the end of the road, and then we're climbing down a crane hook outside of the bounds of the city.
This was the joke in the past. I don't know if I've officially said it, but I've said, are you really going to end the game with Motorball? And so this is, for all intents and purposes, the end of Midgar in OG. It's going to be a long, long time before you can come back here. I remember thinking, when do we get to go back to Midgar? And turns out you really don't in the way you expect.
You're going to go back to Midgar after you go back to almost every other place on the map.
Yeah, pretty much.
Save for a few. In OG, when we wrap up defeating Motorball, this is at the end of the highway. Barrett says, well, what do we do now? Sephiroth is alive, says Cloud. I have to settle the score. And then Barrett says, and that'll save the planet? Cloud says, yes. Barrett goes, all right, I'm going. And Aerith says, I'll go too. I have things I want to find out. Cloud asks, do you mean about the ancients? And she says, ... many things. And then Tifa says, I guess this is goodbye, Midgar. Now, with the end of the highway being the end, it's kind of an analogy about where these heroes are going. So we're at the end of Midgar. The geography of the moment is explaining that we are going to like hop off of this highway of Midgar and get into the rest of the world. And so we split. The next scene, we see everybody climbing down the end of a crane over the city limits, and it's the wasteland that we see. There's that melancholic version of the Final Fantasy VII main theme when the scene plays out, and it kind of feels like a farewell. Well, it is a farewell, but the music is leaning into it as well. Then we have a chance to assemble our proper party. Depending on who you assemble into your proper party, with Cloud being the one that has to be in the party, you get funny reactions from other people that aren't invited into the party, depending on the makeup of the party. In my experience, I gathered the two ladies together, and Barrett has a comment like, oh, what?
If Cloud chooses Aeris and Tifa for his party, he says, thought you'd do that. Cloud chooses Barrett and Red 13 for his party. Aeris says, unexpected. Tifa then follows up, combination. Well, have fun with just the guys. We'll see you at Calm.
Right. So let's give the postmortem on original. So this is the first 6 hours of the game, if you're doing decent, maybe 8. If you're new at RPGs or chose to do a little more grinding or had trouble with bosses and got some game overs and stuff. It's a classic experience in RPGs. It's genre defining. I think it did a lot for steampunk in gaming, because I don't think there was very much of that prior to 1997.
Right.
Although other games were very steampunky that came out about this time, I'm going to name drop Septeracore as one of them. Definitely not popular, but I do recall that one. And it breaks the mold, because we're not going through the 8 dungeons. We're not going through the 8 reactors. We have revealed that there's going to be a whole world trekking experience throughout the game. And my God, we're about to start it. And so it feels like an all new beginning, having escaped Midgar. Now we're traveling the world map. We weren't traveling a world map ever in the game so far. The journey feels like it's really just begun, although it's been so riveting so far.
Again, we've talked about this, but the idea of like, can you make a whole game out of Midgar? People saying the original was so impeccably paced that extending it out or padding it or anything like that is going to ruin the experience. But for me, it's kind of like this thing of, it was so good and so magical that, you know, you just wanted more and more of it. And I think the thing for me that really sticks out about Midgar is the story of Midgar is so rich in terms of the like plotting of the game and the things that develop and the twists and turns that you kind of learn along the way. Whereas the segment after it, not that I'm reviewing or comparing the two, but just to kind of highlight how jam-packed Midgar is the segment after it is a long, long stretch of the plot being follow the guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really filling that out with character stories along the way. So it's still wonderful and still got a lot of fun things to do. But as far as like plot goes, not a lot there. A significant chunk of the game is just like, hey, you're on your world tour now. Cool. Maybe old Final Fantasy fans were wondering for hours and hours, where is my world map? Is this game getting a world map the same way maybe like you and I playing Final Fantasy X, we were like, where the F is the world map? And they finally did do away with that convention. I wonder if people were feeling that about Midgar, of like, this is so different and so unique for the series at the time. But yeah, to kind of contrast it against that, like, follow the guy plot, Midgar has so many twists and turns because it's reactors, then it's helping Aerith, then it's the Wall Market situation, then it's you're kind of on defense with dropping of the plate and responding to that, and then it becomes rescue Aerith, and this at the climax of all of this whole new element is developed about Sephiroth. And you just think like, that was 5 hours straight of like nonstop rock and roll, you know, as far as the story goes. So I think that's the thing that maybe rubs the people the wrong way, that it's different in remake, that like it's not as breakneck. But to me, the flip side of it is Midgar's story is so rich that I think there's more depths to dive into that maybe the original didn't do. You're just going so fast through so many things. And the spectacle of it all is just like overwhelming, you know?
I do know. Yeah, yeah. It's so rich. And I want to give a shout out to the like environmental characteristics. Midgar as a character, or having character, like every nook and cranny has some like special design to it, or it's got graffiti on the wall, or my god, these people are living inside of a like a broken pipe, or the backgrounds and the environments were just so incredible and give so much character to this enormous city. It's astonishing to behold, nothing like it prior to any other game to my recollection in gaming. It's the scope and the detail is so vast for its time.
Yeah, and like I've mentioned, it completely changed my trajectory as an artist. Prior to that, I was like just drawing Ninja Turtles and Power Rangers, people beating each other up, you know, and now it's like I'm thinking environments, I'm thinking mood, I'm thinking lighting, I'm thinking mazes, and like turning these places I'm drawing into being a game designer in my head. I wonder, would this be a good traversal area or something like that? Because Final Fantasy VII did that to my brain. Mm. You did want to speak to every human being and see like, what do they have to say about it? You did get a lot of the ground level feeling of like what it was like to live in the slums because of chatting with it. Even the little kid that's just like, you old geezer, you need a place to stay. You know, like this kid is like rough and he's swindling people at his little hotel bedroom that probably isn't even really his. Huh. Even this 8-year-old is a scam artist in the slums down here. You just learn the environment you're in by talking to every single person, no matter how inconsequential they are.
Yeah, my God. Okay, well, I guess that about wraps OG. Should we get back to Remake?
Yep.
Okay. Well, in the glory kill cutscene of destroying Mortarball, Red 13 jumps onto Cloud's bike, then leaps off of it to rake Mortarball's head, while Cloud uses the bike's inertia to slice through the chassis of Mortarball. Red lands back onto the truck, no problem. The two vehicles drive off the highway's dead end, but Mortarball doesn't have enough juice to clear the jump. It falls down and explodes. Then Cloud sees Sephiroth standing before a series of highway toll booths, and both vehicles come to a stop. And then he disappears, but not before a black feather falls before Cloud. Here we are at Destiny's Crossroads. That's what we're titling this end of the highway. There's a save point, the last vending machine we're probably going to find in this game. We walk over to the end of the highway and another black feather falls. Sephiroth descends from the sky, Mazamune out and ready. Aerith tells Sephiroth he's wrong, but wrong about what?
And you're wrong.
The abrupt ambiguity is rather weird to me, and I'm pulling from Star Wars here. If just saying people are wrong didn't work for Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi, it probably won't work here either.
What quote are you referencing there?
She just calls him he's wrong. She just says he's wrong. Oh, you mean Luke Skywalker?
Yeah.
Oh, in The Last Jedi, where he's like, everything you said right in front of me was wrong. That's the thing he says that we come back to, that you hear in like act one and then it comes back to in act three. So dumb. If you blocked it out, good on you. You don't remember it?
No, I kind of just remember what he meant. Ray was saying something and it's like, incredible. Everything you said was wrong.
What do you know about the Force?
It's a power that Jedi have that lets them control people and make things float.
Impressive. Every word in that sense was wrong. Lesson one.
That Force does not belong to the Jedi.
This is a whole nother discussion, but Luke in Last Jedi has this thing that I like to call honest dialogue. A lot of Star Wars fans have this thing where they talk about like, oh, the Jedi were so cool and so powerful and they did this. And then Luke is just like, at the height of their power, they let the Emperor rise and they all got murdered.
Lesson two. Now that they're extinct, the Jedi are romanticized, deified. If you strip away the myth and look at their deeds, the legacy of the Jedi is failure, hypocrisy, hubris.
That's not true.
At the height of their powers, they allowed Darth Sidious to rise, create the Empire, and wipe them out. It was a Jedi Master who was responsible for the training and creation of Darth Vader.
and a Jedi who saved him.
Yeah, they're not as good as you think they are. Luke has a lot of these moments of pretty honest dialogue in the face of Rey's idealism or ignorance about who the Jedi actually were.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of think, like, I get it. The one with Kylo Ren at the end, Kylo Ren makes a statement, and it's like this three-piece statement that Luke breaks it down and says, here's why.
The Resistance is dead. The war is over. And when I kill you, I will have killed the last Jedi.
Amazing. Every word of what you just said was wrong. The Rebellion is reborn today. The war is just beginning, and I will not be the last Jedi.
I remember it making sense in my head at the time. It's been, what, 5 years ago?
Okay, I get what you mean, that it makes more sense there than here.
I think it makes sense to me here, too, though, with Aerith. Not that, like, oh, Sephiroth, your opinions are wrong. She's got, like, weird precog timeline stuff feeding into her head throughout this entire game, and here there's just this big fucking gravy stain on the white shirt of events. No, this human is not supposed to be here right now, or like, if she's not the one feeling it, the voices of the planet and the voices of fate are screaming in her head of, this is wrong, this man should not be standing here right now, you're supposed to just leave, everything about this moment is fucked up, is kind of the way I interpreted that statement. Like, she's seeing something just by him standing there. She's like, I'm having a moment right now.
Just by you being born, you're an aberration. You're messing with the timeline, another aberration.
For sure. You just existing in this moment is not right.
I get it. I just don't think it's very good writing. Like, you're wrong.
No, I get you.
We don't need to get hung up on it. Maybe we should just move past it.
I kind of agree with you as far as dialogue quality, not good, but I don't think that it doesn't make sense, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. Sephiroth says, those with clouded eyes see nothing but shadows. And then Aerith says, everything about you is wrong. But Sephiroth continues, all born are bound to her. Should this world be unmade, so too shall her children. And then Cloud says, the world won't end today, but you will. And then Sephiroth says, listen. Now, before we move on to the next beat, I want to circle back to what he says. All people born are bound to her, and that should this world be unmade, so too shall her children.
All born are bound to her. Should this world be unmade, so too shall her children.
Now, it isn't clear to me that he's seeking out the end of the world,
mm-hmm.
because her being Jenova, of course, he's more her children than anybody else.
Right.
But so too is Cloud to a certain extent. And if you believe that everyone on the planet, including, you know, proper ancients like Aerith, are descendants of ancients, then maybe we mean all humankind,
mm-hmm.
or all life forms. I don't know. So, like, the scope of the warning isn't very clear to me. What's your take on that?
So I think the way that I'm reading this moment with Sephiroth is that saying everyone is bound to the planet, and if the planet dies, we all die. So he's kind of, in a way, he's talked to Cloud in the second chapter about the planet is suffering and something needs to change. We know Sephiroth's goal from OG, which is to essentially remake the planet. And so maybe in his head, he's saying the only way for me to save the planet from, like, Shinra, this humans running around sucking up all the energy and everything, the only way to save the planet is I need the power of a god. I need to not just become a god and be this big, evil, malevolent ruler, but, like, I will have the power and the capability to, when a Shinra-like man arises to greedily take what he wants from the planet, I can just say, no, fuck you, stop, and reforge and reheal and remake the planet as I see fit. We've talked about the precogging and the connections and who's what and where. We've already addressed that in our Whispers episode. But if I were to just take this on face value of saying this is Sephiroth, analogous to Sephiroth at this time period in OG, he thinks that he is a Setra descendant and that Jenova is a Setra. Now, we talked about that. I did my little post-production in the previous episode about how Sephiroth in the basement reading the details and the history of the Setra. So he has incomplete information at this point in time. If this Sephiroth we're talking to in remake is in the same time journey as Sephiroth in OG, which I am not sure is the case. Very confusing to try and put into words.
No, I get it, man. I wonder if, this just came to me, I wonder if Genova is holding hostage the planet's life.
Right.
If should this world be unmade, so too shall her children. Does that mean if Genova, like Genova has so putrefied the life stream that removing her would be like destroying the planet? But then again, Sephiroth doesn't aim to destroy the planet. He aims to, you know, we know the mission of the Black Materia enough to know that he wants to harm it enough to gather, to be at the nexus of the gathering.
Right.
Life stream power.
And if we're thinking that this is a Sephiroth that is post all of these revelations and knowledge and everything like that, then like a Sephiroth intertwined into the life stream the same way he is in the Advent Children era, then this statement could be read as, if the planet dies, so too do her children. I am not one of the planet's children. Genova is not one of the planet's children. Mm. Your whole life stream can fucking explode and you're all going to wither and die. But this alien from the skies that is empowered by something else will be fine. So I think maybe it's like perhaps egging them on. But if I go back to, like I said, the early stages of the game on what he's doing to kind of goad Cloud, I think Sephiroth is doing something new that we don't quite understand yet. And he actually needs Cloud. I'm saying he's trying to convince them, follow down my path, do it my way, because your alternative is oblivion. Shinra is going to suck up all of this, all the Mako. You're all going to wither. You're all going to die with the planet. Just like the scene in Bugenhagen's little planetarium where all the people are phasing into the planet and then being reborn or whatever, but then he sucks all the energy out and the planet crumbles into nothingness. That is what Shinra's doing. And so Sephiroth saying, hey, my path is the path to fix this. Join me. And then we're kind of like saying, fuck no. That's what I'm taking away from it in this moment. He's trying to win us over.
Yeah, he is trying to get Cloud to do something. And I remember that from what he says to Cloud in the vision hallucination in Chapter 2 in the alleyway. He wants Cloud to do something. And, well, we're not too clear on what it is yet, but as we're coming to the end of the game here, it's right around the corner, whatever it is.
My biggest takeaway is that he just wants to change the events of OG. He doesn't like the whole I got my ass kicked thing. So that's what he's trying to do, is find a new one.
I don't want to lose. Yeah, leveraging the whispers in some sort of way. Anyways, I'm going to go back to the events. So the last thing Sephiroth says is, listen. And then whispers explode out of the Shinra building towards us all. Their movements make us feel like we are in a storm, and we can hear the sounds of screaming.
Listen.
We cut away from that, and what the hell is going on? Cloud is nursing his forehead, and we flash to the wasteland outside of Midgar. We see a dome of whispers covering the city, and then we see a man with a buster sword on his back. He walks into frame, and oh my god, Nate, it's Zack.
We don't know who Zack is if this is our first time playing it for the listeners.
This is your first time playing Remake, and having not played original, this must be very confusing to you.
Yes.
Yes. A man wearing Cloud's sword with black hair, spiky, but in a different sort of way, with a similar sort of look and body type, comes into frame. Symphonic hero music plays when the reveal drops, and we hear him say, "We drag our asses all this way, and this is the welcome we get."
We drag our asses all this way, and this is the welcome we get.
I don't really actually recall if they name him Zack. You just see a guy with black hair wearing Cloud's sword. So maybe it's just guy with black hair wearing Cloud's sword, hears a sound, turns around, and sees 100 Shinra forces and an attack helicopter that have Zack in their sights. A few whispers are pathing between the hostile units as they go. Zack says, "Boy, oh boy, the price of freedom is steep," and he readies his sword. Then he says to himself, "Embrace your dreams, and whatever happens, protect your honor as a soldier," and he charges the 100 dudes with rifles pointed at him.
Embrace your dreams. And whatever happens, protect your honor as a soldier.
If you're around any sort of Final Fantasy media of any kind, you've probably seen Crisis Core. You've probably seen the cover of the new game Rebirth, the promotional material of that. So you've probably seen him. But Zach was this dude that the first time any of us saw him in 97, 98 was at a moment of like a big plot reveal where basically at a moment where you should be seeing something that depicts Cloud, you would then instead see a dude with long black hair in place of Cloud. And you just have this moment of like, what the fuck? Like, I don't know about you, but I kind of had this like crisis of, no, this is a lie. This is wrong. I am the hero.
Yeah, you go, that's not right.
Cloud's the hero. Cloud kicks ass. There's no way. This is bullshit. It's a trick. Having the ground knocked out from under you is like the original Zach experience. So, but this does come out of left field in maybe not the same shock value, but if you're a Final Fantasy VII aficionado, the question of why are we seeing this scene right now, right here, is a pretty big one of like, wait a sec, wait, what? Why am I seeing this? Because like this canonically in the timeline happened 2 years prior to seven. Is that right? Or some amount of time earlier. I don't know how long Cloud bopped around Midgar before he started blowing up reactors and then this scene. So there's some amount of time between the two. We are not escaping Midgar. Obviously, Cloud is not escaping Midgar while also being on a cliffside being held by Zack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just like a flashback or a memory. We're seeing the whispers circling around Midgar here in this time period as well. So it's super confusing. I'm still confused about this, if I'm being honest.
It is funny to me that the writers have leveraged Zack for multiple like left field shocks.
Yeah.
He's a hero in certain contexts, but he's also like this strange MacGuffin where it's supposed to blow your hair back.
Right.
More than once, now that I'm thinking on it, over the course of the franchise, we'll just call him Mr. Left Field.
And there's also this dialogue that he gives here. When you're playing through Remake, you have a lot of moments where, let's say, the dialogue of a scene or the composition of a scene is being repurposed or reinterpreted for the modern audience. You meeting Aerith in the church, or you hanging out with Tifa at the bar, she's making you your drink while talking about her woes. It's in spirit the same things being said as OG, but not literally the same things being said, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this here, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't played it in forever. This is the exact same speech Zach gives at the end of Crisis Core, kind of canonizing that experience in a way, right?
We can double check that they are the same. But I am willing to confirm for you that both scenes muse on the meaning of what it is to be a soldier.
Right.
Because throughout the game, Angeal, Genesis, and Zack all philosophize about what it means to be a soldier, bravery and selflessness and things like that. And it all kind of comes to a head when Zack turns around, digs his heels into the ground, and faces his pursuers.
I know that line, embrace your dreams. I've heard that spoken both by him and Angeal in Crisis Core. Like, mm-hmm. That's rattling around my brain. So I want to say it's interesting to me that Remake is like rewriting, recontextualizing scenes from OG, but pulling straight from compilation materials, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm into it, man.
I'm more and more thinking about your theory that there are multiple different timelines besides just OG and then Remake. We now have to contend with the prior to anyone fucking with the events. There's now compilation stuff being referenced in Remake pre-Divergence of Fate that is correct to compilation, but not correct to OG, meaning there's probably a separate compilation timeline as well. That's a whole, like, that's fucking word salad to anyone who isn't a hardcore fan of this series. But I'm definitely seeing the light on what you told me earlier of like, we're not just talking two realities here.
I'm with you. Yeah. Compilation timeline being what I called quote unquote true OG.
Oof. That's a bullet to my chest of saying the realest one is the worst one.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll find out. We haven't seen every payoff yet.
Here's my little hope among hopes. And as somebody who has not received an answer for this in my time with Rebirth either, in any way, shape, or form, I'm hoping that what happens at the end of all this is there is a like OG Final Fantasy VII timeline quarantined in and of itself. Then there's someone did some fucking with timelines and then we got compilation materials. Because if you remember in Crisis Core, there's scenes where it's like the Sephiroth Nibelheim flashback. Apparently, like Genesis is just the whole time like hanging out in the rafters, climbing on the ceiling, like whispering in Sephiroth's ear.
I knew ever since I was a child, I was not like the others. Am I a human being?
You are a monster. You were the greatest monster created by the Genova Project.
And it's dumb as hell. If we can quarantine that into its own stupid timeline and say that's a different one and purify OG from the stupid compilation stuff, and then Remake can have its own, you know, that would be the best scenario for me is like we've have eras of Final Fantasy VII and everybody who is beefing on this idea of Remake doing multiple reality timelines. It's like, well, it actually fixed the whole compilation issue for me, if I'm being honest, of I can now in canon ignore compilation materials and say, well, that's a separate reality. Like they helped me in that regard.
Doubtful, man. You're asking for a Nomura Hall pass. I don't think he's going to be dishing them out.
Well, also, Nomura is an offender in this regard. Like, it's so weird to say this because, like, I love these games and I love the content these people make, but I also have to think, like, I would never make 65% of the decisions they make. And I have to lump Kitase in with that as well. Like, the guy loves Final Fantasy. He lives and breathes it his entire life. He's responsible for some of the most powerful moments we've had in gaming. And then also he'll give interviews about his opinions on scenes and ways in which he would change Final Fantasy 8 or 10 down the road, or like fan theories he likes. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, dude. Do not ever touch this game again. Do not remake Final Fantasy 8, please, because he's like a nut job, in my opinion.
Our brains are spaghetti scrambled eggs, and it's exhausting.
And Zach has done it again. He's fucked us again.
Poor guy. All he wants to do is live.
Yeah.
And we're like, no, no.
Get out of here.
We're the anti-whispers. No, we are the whispers.
Yeah.
We are the world. Okay, so cutting back to the end of the highway, Sephiroth cuts a portal through a current of whispers and walks into it. And he says, I'm waiting, Cloud, as he does. Aerith clarifies that this is the point of no return and casts a spell that reduces the portal's chaotic instability so that maybe we can pass through it as well. And she says, we're at Destiny's crossroads. Cloud looks at her and says, then why did you stop me? Stop me from engaging with Sephiroth. And Aerith goes, I'm not really sure. And Tifa wonders, what will we find on the other side of this portal? And Aerith says, freedom. Boundless, terrifying freedom, like a great, never-ending sky.
Boundless, terrifying freedom, like a great, never-ending sky.
And when she says it, it's an analogy about you and me and listeners engaging with this media.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of that portal, we're going to confront what we know about Final Fantasy VII, OG, in this sense. And beyond it, we may never be the same. Or the game world, the lore, the media may never be the same once we pass through this portal. We're emancipating ourselves from fate or from our preconceived notions of what OG means and what Rebirth could mean in other subsequent games in the franchise.
They could take every moment from OG and do it justice and like amp it up and add dozens of hours of majestic wonder to it, or they could just completely gut an experience and make it the worst fucking thing I've ever seen, and I want to die the entire segment that I'm there. They could deliver both of those things in the same game because it's now completely free to do so.
Boundless, terrifying freedom, Nate. And when she says freedom, we hear the beginning of the bombing mission music play. The Dun, 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 dun. We are rehearing the first few notes of the game's very first song.
Right.
Which is also informing us that through music, we're about to start over again.
I almost like attribute that to like the, it's just a short little chime, but you have to kind of give it like the life stream theme in a way.
Oh, I agree with you. Yes.
It's like in that green glow, it's looking at Aerith's face. I think a planetary energy, a Gaia-esque energy when I hear that tune.
I believe that as well. In regards to the screaming before the Zach section, Aerith says, "What you heard then was the voices of the planet, those born into this world who lived and died." And when she's speaking, it's very profound and you hang on every word. She sounds like a prophet, and to a certain extent she is. The words that she says are so hallowed and very, very important. Those born into this world, those who lived and died, and who returned, they're all howling in pain. Cloud clarifies, because of Sephiroth, and Aerith nods, their words, they don't reach him. All these moments and memories, precious and fleeting, they're like rain rolling off his back. And when they're gone, he won't cry or shout or anything. He'll tell you that he only cares about the planet, that he'd do everything in his power to protect and preserve it. But this isn't the way it's supposed to be. There is no greater threat to the planet than him. Sephiroth has to be stopped. He has to be. And that's why, and then dot, 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 I'm asking you to help me. I know that together we can do this, but if we do, we'll be changing more than fate itself. If we succeed, if we win, we'll be changing ourselves. And it's for that reason, that's maybe why I hesitated.
I'm asking you to help me. I know that together we can do this. But if we do, we'll be changing more than fate itself. If we succeed, if we win, we'll be changing ourselves. I guess, maybe, that's why I hesitated.
The ancient spirits wail again, and we all cover our ears because it's a horrific cacophony of screaming. And then Cloud says, "You said it yourself, he has to be stopped. And frankly, I've heard enough howling for a lifetime." And I want to hang on that comment for a second, because the howling that Cloud is referring to isn't necessarily the howling of the voices of the life stream. After all, he's not very in tune with it in the same way that Aerith is. He's referring to his own personal issues, his demons, his identity crisis that some players are aware of and some aren't, depending on your exposure to OG. He's heard enough howling for a lifetime.
I think it could also mean for him, the most impactful, important moment of Sephiroth is watching his whole hometown be murdered and burned down right before his eyes.
Oh, a practical memory.
Yeah, maybe that's like a record replaying in his head over and over. Every time you see on the newsstand, somebody's has like an article of like, back in 1996, Sephiroth had a mission and blah, blah, blah. And he just reads that word, Sephiroth, and he's sent back there immediately. From the perspective of the regular people of Midgar, he's this old hero that fought valiantly in the Wutai War and just kind of mysteriously disappeared, but had all these successful missions and everything. But from Cloud's perspective, every time he thinks of him, he's taken back to that place. Maybe, right?
Yeah. And after you articulated that point, I kind of wonder if it is his identity crisis that he's lumping into that pain he's describing, because as far as we can tell, he's getting along with that identity crisis quite nicely.
Yeah.
I mean, he dodged Kunsul and all that stuff. And so I'm oh my God, Nate. Maybe some of those voices screaming in his ear are from the Nibelheim fire and massacre.
Uh-huh.
Why shouldn't they be the same person? People.
Right.
Why couldn't it be Mom?
And that's the thing is, chapter two, like, we get a Sephiroth intrusion, but it's also indicative of a burning Nibelheim, right?
Yeah. Yep.
There's connections there with the incident and everything. And essentially the second he swipes at Sephiroth, all the flames just go away. So there's something going on where he's being pulled back to that moment. And Sephiroth is at the heart of being pulled there. Enough howling for a lifetime.
That's a pretty badass thing to say.
Yeah.
Quite brave. Very cool. So we go into the portal. Well, if you're ready to, because this is the point of no return, maybe you go sit on that bench, maybe go shop at the vending machine.
The vending machine that sits at the end of a expressway that doesn't exist. I guess maybe the construction workers use it, right?
Yes. To get their 3 materia slot bangles.
Yes.
And ethers.
I still like completely laugh at the bench idea because like in other situations, you're like, yeah, I'll have a rest as I'm traversing the Sector 7 slums after beating up some monsters. And then you have, okay, the world's about to end. There's a portal fluttering in the background. I'm just going to spend, 45 minutes here on this bench, rest my ass cheeks for a little bit and everything will be okay.
His glutes are sore after that motorcycle ride.
It's true. I had a friend who rode his motorcycle all the way home from Sturgis to Wisconsin and like couldn't walk for a week. And I was like, don't people do that all the time? He's like, yeah, they have like traditional motorcycles. He's on a crotch rocket the whole way. So definitely Cloud has the on the Hardy Daytona, he rides in the crotch rocket pose. So I can definitely see he needs a nice bench break.
Good for him. Well deserved. When we're ready, we'll tell Aerith we're ready. She's the gatekeeper of the readiness. And Tifa goes, never tried to challenge Destiny. Then Red 13 says, this could be her last line of defense, her being Destiny. It won't be easy. Cloud says, let's mosey. I'm kidding. He says, let's go. Did you feel like a let's mosey moment coming up in your heart of hearts, Nate?
No, because Cloud has to be comfortable being a dumbass. That's the let's mosey moment is you. This is a whole bigger discussion, but once Cloud is his true, genuine self, that's when you get the let's mosey. And Sid's like, God damn, you're such a loser now. Like, can't you say something cool? Because before that, he was always the cool badass.
The mosey is exempt of the squishing. Barrett says, wouldn't be the first time I spit in Destiny's eye. Whether you can see the seams or you can't, doesn't change that she's always trying to have her way. Daddy's coming home real soon, honey. So the she isn't Marlene. That's the second she. The first she is again, Destiny. I kind of wonder, the she, Destiny is a direct message to the fans, to the players. Like, wouldn't be the first time I spit in, well, I don't know if Barrett's spit in our eye specifically, but whether you can see the seams or you can't, it doesn't change that gamers like us are always trying to have it their way.
Right.
And then I don't know if I want to ride this analogy anymore, because if he goes, daddy's coming home real soon, is he calling us dad? He's talking to us and calling himself daddy to us. So I don't want a daddy relationship with Barrett.
I think it doesn't matter if you want it or not. Barrett sees himself as the daddy of the party, of the player, of everybody. He's got his sermons. He's got his messages. He's hooting and hollering on the camera. He's Big Daddy.
He's got a cute nickname for you. Honey. Nate, you're Barrett's honey.
That's fine. I'll take it.
Right.
So the next area is called the Singularity, the area we step into. Now, we probably all know what that means, but the term is from Einstein's theory of general relativity, and it's the center of a black hole in which not even light can escape. It is so dense. We're talking about the crossroads of fate, as the chapter is talking about. If this is the singularity of fate, this is the point we've stepped into where if we're making alterations outside of Sephiroth slicing through whispers, us shooting at whispers, trying to change things, Wedge seemingly making it to the Shinra building and the whisper saying, no, you shouldn't be fucking be here. I'm going to push you out a window. Now we're in the singularity. We're at the heart of this. So it's like not even light can escape this place. You have no fucking chance of changing fate in this center of everything. So that's what we're going to be dealing with next time is what the hell do you do when you're in the singularity of fate? Shoot it with a Gatling gun?
Yeah, that is an option that is not outside of the conversation.
Bullets can't kill you in a random battle, but man, if you shoot at fate with some bullets, you're going to fuck it up.
Destiny can't melt steel bullets, right?
Yes.
Steel bullets can't melt Destiny buildings. Thanks for listening, everybody. As you know well by now, this episode has been a production of Gunblade Guys. That's the collaboration of Nate and Tyler right here. because we've got all kinds of other stuff besides this podcast. Nate's doing most of it.
I've taken a little bit of a break recently, but yes, there is other stuff.
Yes, there's other stuff. We're on Twitch, we're on YouTube, and there's probably more things that we're going to do over or in between during some downtime. I would love to get more Xenoblade episodes published to YouTube, and that might be a good time to do that. Then again, I'm also ankle deep in Rebirth.
Right.
Cut me a break, guys.
And moving.
And, oh my God, I'm moving at the end of the month, too. And none of you volunteered to help me move.
I'm going to check the email and make sure we don't have any moving emails.
That would be amazing. Think about liking us, subscribing to us, five-starring us, and writing a review about us as well. Think about telling a fellow game liker about us as well. I think that would be nice. Join the conversation with fellow fans of the show on Discord. You can find a link to our Discord in our podcast description paragraph. Think about tipping us as well. You can find a link to do that as well in that paragraph.
I just thought about tipping us and then I didn't. I did not tip us. I just thought about it.
And if you want to communicate with us, you can do it in any other way besides emailing us at gunbladeguys@gmail.com.
There's no emails.
No surprises there. What, you don't want to lift an armoire for me?
Gold Saucer solved this issue, but like the thing is it probably took me 9 months to beat this game because I was actually really bad at it and I would take breaks. And this is part of my like analysis of like analyzing Rebirth and things like that and like how much the open world grind there was and everything. So going back to OG, I had played some RPGs before, but I didn't really like at the age of 10 conceptualize the idea of the grind. I just wanted to go see the next thing. And then when I die, I just had this feeling of like, I'm bad at the game or I don't understand it. And so like, I legitimately, I think, took like a 3-4 week break after Gin Atak in Cosmo Canyon because just could not kill him. Tried like 30 times. And it's because literally I didn't know extra additional content, you know, side stuff that you know about, like, oh, Yuffie's in the forest, or you can go save the little chocobo chick in the train tracks or whatever. I didn't know any of that stuff existed. So it was really just like run to the next screen. Okay, story time. Yay. So I would create all these little save points in case like I would feel like I had hard locked myself into a spot. And then it wasn't until like playthrough maybe like 3 that it started clicking, like you can just run around in a circle and get your stats up and then you'll just murder everything. So yeah, I was actually pretty bad at RPGs because like this was the first one that I took more seriously than the others. I think the other ones were all action RPGs like Illusion of Gaia, where there's some measure of like skill to those games to where you can outskill some of the stupidity of not grinding, but you
with
know
with your movements,
your
micro,
like, and like Zelda and stuff like that. So yeah, this was the first one where it's just like you just have to invest. It's more of a test of endurance and knowledge than a test of like can you push the button correctly, you know. So anyway, all that to say, I had a save point before the bike thing.
You crashing? Hello? Something's happening to Nate. Where's my boy? I heard a little bit of your sound, and then you cut out. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum.
Hello?
Hello.
Okay.
I hear you.
Cool, I guess.
How you doing? What's going on?
Who the hell knows, honestly? Computers. So I don't know where I was. Fuck it. Who cares?
Fuck it. Who cares?
In this economy, I'm cutting all of this, I think. Whatever. All right.
All right.
I think that's a little bit better of a peace out than Daddy Barrett.